Committee on Revenue for May 30th, 2007 will come to order. I want to announce that Senate Bill 859 has additional amendments coming. They are not here. We're holding that bill over until Monday, and I think it's already been posted for Monday. Is that right, Paul? So if you're here for Senate Bill 859 and nothing else, you're excused. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 69.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity of working with the Oregon Lottery Commission and the Oregon Lottery proponents on the Burns Lottery Warm Site. At this time, we find no reason amongst the various members to not proceed with a recommendation on behalf of staff, which I understand Mazin is about to give us.
Mazin.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 69. Just to quickly refresh your memory, it's one line bill that says the state is no longer obligated to maintain an emergency lottery computer database center in Burns. And the discussions was to whether this is feasible at this time or not, and as you have heard, the negotiations are coming to the conclusion that it is. And with that, Mr. Chair, there is no revenue impact for this measure. The fiscal is a little different. The fiscal office, as it looks at this, it sees that no immediate fiscal relief or savings, because the assumption that it might or might not sell, or that kind of issues that are in the uncertain realm rather than ironclad.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 69 to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 69 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember when we had the good testimony from Director Penn that there would be a couple of employees that were dispersed by this. I'm wondering if they are, or displaced, I should say. I'm wondering if they'll be redirected within the system or not, or if we know about that. And I thought I saw Mr. Penn here, and he just give me a head nod if I don't see him now, though. Oh, there he is right there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Broom, Dale Penn, Oregon Lottery Director, and this bill actually does nothing about those employees, and they are DAS employees, and DAS does not have a legislative requirement. This bill only applies to the lottery. We have no employees there. It is my understanding that DAS and Representative Butler would know much more about this. He's gone and visited both employees, but they are working with those employees, and I do know they would have some rights. But this issue of selling the center would very much impact them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Dale. Colleagues, these two ladies do, in fact, reside in the greater Burns-Hines area. Their families have acquired small ranches or farms, and they're very much integrated into the community. It is going to work a hardship on these two families. And Judge Grasty, the county judge from Harney County, has expressed grave concern over the loss of any public jobs, but is grateful for the public employment that we do have there with the OYA and the other state offices that are in Burns and Hines, and recognizes that if they can culminate the use of the warm site for some other purpose that could actually bring jobs to Harney County, that those two jobs may be augmented with many more. And Director Penn has indicated that the portion of the warm site that is occupied by the lottery is it's functioning, it's up and running, but it operates without employees. It operates by camera and by computer. The other, the DAS portion of it operates with the two full-time employees that shift off and switch off. There used to be a third one, but they're just down to two. And these folks are invested in the community at this point. My hope is that we'd be able to find them through the Department of Administrative Services other opportunities to work with other state agencies, but this truly would be a loss of the community if we can't do something with the disposition of the one site.
Thank you.
Other further discussion?
I don't see any. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 69 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler, will you carry?
I can, yes, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Butler will carry, and we close the work session on Senate Bill 69. And we open a public hearing on House Bill 2966.
Chris. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2966 is being replaced. You should have a dash one amendment in front of you, but you should also have a piece of paper in front of you that's entitled Policy Options for House Bill 2966. And the essence of the language that's currently in the dash one is very similar to what's listed as Option B. But to give you a flavor for what the intent of the amendments were doing, I was going to walk through this handout and describe the results.
Please do.
Okay. There was a work group headed up by Representative Butler to look at ways to increase the earned income credit and alternatives for paying for that increase in the EIC. And what you have before you are two options, Option A and Option B. Option A would increase the EIC starting in 2008 from 6% to 12%, and it would make the EIC permanently refundable. Under current law, the EIC in 07 is at 5%. It's scheduled to go to 6% in 08, and it's scheduled to be refundable from 2006 through 2010. So from 08 to 10, we have a 6% refundable credit. And then starting with tax year 2011, the refundability sunsets, but it stays at 6%. So what you have here in terms of paying for it, the policy option was a phase out of the personal exemption credit for high income folks or higher income folks. And that is done in two stages here. The first block of that table is for tax years 2008 through 2010. And that the reason it's done that way is because that's the structure of the EIC for those years is the same. And then in 2011, there is a more aggressive, if you will, phase out of the exemption credit because the impact of increasing the EIC becomes much more expensive in those years because current law is that it loses its refundability. And so we see for 08 to 10, the phase out there for the single folks is between $125,000 and $150,000. And in each of those categories, those taxpayers would get the corresponding percentage of their personal exemption credit. So, for example, single filers with income between $125,000 and $130,000 at HEI would get 75% of the statutory personal exemption credit and so forth. In 2011, that phase-out percentages are the same, but the income level is reduced. So now the income range over which it is phased out is reduced from $125,000 to $150,000 down to $100,000 to $125,000, thereby raising more revenue. And at the bottom of the table there, we have the revenue impacts, and it's broken out for the earned income credit, where we can see the cost there is $25 million in 07-09, $48 million in 09-11, and $74 million in 11-13. And again, the reason it becomes much more expensive there is because the policy would change from a non-refundable credit to a refundable credit. And that's more indicative of what that long-term impact would be. That's why I've included the 11-13 biennium. The The personal exemption credit would raise $22 million, $39 million, and then $60 million. And so what we have here in these three biennia are, as the numbers here, a revenue loss for each of the biennium with it going from the revenue loss going from $3 million to $13 million in this time period. Option B is the same theme. The difference here is that the EIC, rather than going to 12% immediately in 2008, it increases by 1 percentage point each year from 2007 until 2012. So it's 7%, then 8%, and until it reaches 12%, and then it stays at 12%. So the long-term policy is identical for A and B. It's just how quickly the 12% is reached. And again, it remains permanently refundable. And so, given the changes in the EIC, there's a different phase-out for the personal exemption credit. And in this case, the tax years apply for that. Again, we still have this duality with the phase-out brackets. The first block applies to tax years 2007 through 2010, and there's a year difference there because policy option A started in 2008. And here the phase out there is between income of $125,000 and $150,000. So it's the same income range as policy A. But the phase out percentages are, it's a much more gradual phase out. And actually, even at the high income folks, at the high end, folks are still getting 55% of their statutory exemption credit. In 2011, that block for the phase out is identical to option A. Again, because now we're talking more of the long term policy. And there we see the revenue impacts for 07-09, revenue loss of $16 million from expanding the earned income credit. And that increases to $30 million and then $70 million over the subsequent two biennia. And the phase-out of the personal exemption credit, similar pattern, it would raise $15 million, then $23 million, and then $61 million. Again, in the long term, not quite covering the cost of the 12% refundable EIC. And so the net cost there is a loss of $1 million, increasing to $10 million over those three biennia. And one of the reasons it's structured this way pertains to the votes that would be required to pass the bill under these policy options. And with a negative revenue, with a revenue loss in each of the biennium, the best advice from Legislative Council is that it would not be considered a revenue raiser and therefore would not require a 350 vote. And that's why it's structured this way. The language in the schedules in the dash one are similar to the option B, but they don't line up precisely. I needed to get the request into Ledge Council to have the language drafted while I was still working on what the schedules would be to approach a revenue neutral.
Great. Thank you very much. We have several people signed up who wanted to be heard today on the bill, and to make certain that we understand what we're talking about, we are open on the dash one amendment and on the discussion that Chris just gave us. Mike Leachman, Patty Whitney Wise.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Leachman. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. First, I just want to thank Representative Butler and the rest of the work group for a productive few work group meetings. I think we came out with a solid proposal for both improving the earned income credit and paying for it in a way that I think is a reasonable and good way. The federal government no longer imposes income taxes on families who are poor. The majority of states no longer impose income taxes on families that are poor. Oregon's one of a minority of states that continue to do so. The proposal that that actually both proposal, both option A and option B would change that in Oregon, and we think that that's important. And I'll let Patty really address some of the issues about why that's important. But I just wanted to speak briefly to the two options. I think that obviously, and I think in the work group we came to the conclusion that option A was the better option. It moves us more immediately to the to eliminating taxes on poor families, and because we all agreed that that was the right policy choice, we think that doing it, you know, we ought to go ahead and do it. I've shared with you just one sheet that has two charts on it from a publication that we released last fall called Who's Getting Ahead. And the first chart, the chart on the top, just shows what's happened to the adjusted gross incomes, adjusted for inflation, of the top 1% of taxpayers in Oregon relative to the median taxpaying household. And you'll see that the incomes of the top 1% have about doubled. The graph there, for those of you who in the audience who are unable to see it, the top 1% income looks like Mount Hood, with the median household looking like maybe the Sandy River. Very flat. Again, both of those numbers are adjusted for inflation. If you look then at the second chart, it shows that Mount Hood number is represented largely in the bottom line. Now looking at the second chart of only the top at the top 1% only, and breaking them out between the top 0.1% and the rest of the top 1%, and so the bottom line that used to look like Mount Hood now looks like a minor hill, and the top 1% who have seen their adjusted gross incomes nearly quadruple after inflation since 1980. Now looks like Mount Everest. So phasing out the personal exemption credit as a way to pay for eliminating income taxes on working families in this state is not only accomplishes a good not only accomplishes something that I think most of us agree is good policy, but it does so in a way that's fair and takes into account this extraordinary growth in inequality that we've seen over the last generation. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and committee members, for this chance to testify. My name is Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. And there are a couple of things that have happened since we were last before you. One is the Progress Board came out with their report, and one statistic that I found quite alarming was that two-thirds of workers in the state of Oregon make less than 150% of the poverty level for a family of four. Two-thirds of workers in the state of Oregon make less than $31,000 a year. A lot of people are in this category, or close to this category that we're talking about with the working poor families. And I think we need to be concerned about that. These are families who need to meet their basic needs, and the refundable earned income tax credit is one way we can do that and affect a lot of these families who are making very low wages. The personal exemption credit is $159 per person. It's not a huge amount of money, but it does help many families. For those making over $200,000 a year, we do feel that this would be a small sacrifice on their part, money they probably don't need, that would go to families who are struggling to put food on the table. And that these are families who are working. They're trying to do the right thing, working full-time, meeting all of the requirements of the American way, and still having trouble making ends meet because of the low wages in our state. So we're very strongly in support of this measure, and we hope that you will look seriously at the plan A that the work group came up with as the best strategy, which is bumping the refundable earned income tax credit up to 12% right away, so that those families in poverty, making below poverty wages, will no longer be paying into state taxes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes.
Just a clarification.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. The dash one amendments, I understand, are reflective of option B, correct, Chris? And you folks prefer option A. Am I?
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, that pollen is starting to act again, and I'm going to be like that, I'm afraid, for the next couple of months. Kevin Finney and John Mullen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Kevin Finney, I'm the Public Policy Director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I want to also thank Representative Butler, Reed, and Rosenbaum for their work on the working group on this issue. I'm here a little bit to say amen to the proposals before you and to what Patty Whitney Wise and Mike Leachman had to say. We also prefer option A, although, just to be fair, we'll go to bat for either option A or option B. Our concern is to increase to 12% to make the credit permanently refundable. I just want to highlight three reasons we think this is important. The earned income tax credit is structured in such a way as to provide the right incentives. It helps to encourage people to move into work, to sustain themselves through work, and so we think that's very important. It provides the right incentives. Secondly, it's targeted in such a way as to be particularly effective at getting at childhood poverty. There's more benefits for families with children. It's structured at a higher level. We think it's important to make progress on that. And finally, I would just add that it makes the tax system more equitable. We share in the concerns that having people below the poverty level paying income taxes is something we should move beyond. And for all these reasons, we encourage you to move forward on this effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I also have some very brief comments to make. I've been before this committee twice this session. The first time was to talk about the two bills that were before you on the earned income credit. I was delighted that a work group grew out of that and delighted at the product of that work group and supportive of option A. I'd also say, too, that I was here as a co-chair of the Human Services Coalition to testify on House Bill 2530 about tax reform. The only reason that I bring that up is that, of course, the tax reform discussion, should that bill make it all the way through the session, will then lead to an interim discussion about reforming taxes. But here before you now is an opportunity to do something about taxation that will affect very low-income people. One of the principles that the Human Services Coalition has about tax reform is about fairness and progressivity and who pays, and so I think those go a long way to meeting that particular goal of the Human Services Coalition. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm delighted to be here that we're having this discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Those are all I have signed up on House Bill 2966. Are there others who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2966? I don't see anyone. Representative Butler, did you want to make any remarks on or other members of the work group?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I may.
While we're in public hearing?
First of all, I need to express gratitude to all of these folks that have come forward, particularly those who have participated, Mike and Patty and Kevin, others that have participated in the discussions in Legislative Revenue Office. And this has been a work in progress. The presentation, the LOR presentation, which you've received today, is dated 5:30, and the reason for that is it's hot off the press. This has been a moving target. One of the concerns, Mr. Chair, that I would express is this. We do recognize that we are at the mature end of an economic cycle, and I would like to have permission from the Chair to continue to pursue option A but with a sunset date so that we would have an opportunity both in the 09 and 011 and 11 session to return to address. And if you take a look at option A, you'll see that in 09 we've gone from $3.3 million net cost to 9.7, a 300% change in the number there. So the concern we've got is this, and it's a moving target. This is a work in progress, because what you've got is you've got a factor of the personal exemption, which continues to increase, but for this group of people who Kevin, Mike Leachman has indicated here, a group of folks that can afford to assist with putting food on the table of these folks, that amount goes up, but for those folks it comes down. And then you have the issue of what happens when you move towards a recession. As we move towards any kind of an economic cycle that would start to trim those folks off, they're the first people to trim off. As, again, Mr. Leachman's schedule shows what happens around the 2001-2002 period of time. You see that rather deep waterfalls on the 1% of the group there. What you have then is you have two numbers that start to work or could work in opposition to each other. You have a revenue source which begins to decrease and decline, and a group of folks who are earning very low wages who continue in proportion to be a larger share. So those numbers start to move apart at a more dramatic rate than from 3.3 million to 13.4 million. So, Mr. Chair, with your continued permission and indulgence, I think we would want to have legislative council go ahead and draft the A option rather than the B option, and that we put also sunset language in keeping with the rules of the committee, that we have ascertainable standards, and I'm very comfortable that performance standards can be outlined and can be attained. And that we also then have the opportunity to come back and revisit this issue in 09 and 11 with a 12/31 sunset on the permanent refundability of the earned income tax credit. Just for discussion.
On what year?
12/31/11.
11.
So we would be in session twice, and regular general session twice before that point. And plenty of time to act in the 09 session, but we'll have better figures, and not that the figures are bad, but Mr. Chair, more information and then a better feel, because we're just moving to the full refundability in 07. I mean, we really don't have a great deal of experience other than the national experience. And Oregon, as was brought out, is one of those few states that's taxing its poorest working families.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would like to join Representative Butler in commending the people who worked very hard on this work group. I was also a member of the work group, and I think option A was what we came up with. It's very clear from the testimony we heard. It's pretty shocking to think of two-thirds of Oregon's workforce is making under $31,000 a year, and it's very clear that even in good times, those are people who really need some help, and they need it sooner rather than later. So I think that doing something immediately is really where we need to be. I think that we've come up with a reasonable balance here. I know that we have been taking the position that we would not grant new tax expenditures without sunsets on them. I'm not sure what the length of time the sunset that we've been attaching, but probably this one shouldn't have a shorter sunset than we have put for the many other kinds of tax breaks that we have been considering here. And so just want to speak in favor of option A, and hope that we can get it drafted and move it forward expeditiously.
Thank you. Representative Reed, did you have a comment?
Not particularly, just to thank the folks that were involved, and unfortunately I was not able to be there as often as I would have liked, so thank you.
And the chair unfortunately needs to make an additional comment, and that's the looking at the net total item at the bottom of the page, and the size of that number is, I have to say, quite daunting given the dollars we have available. I think what we ought to do is go ahead and draft the amendment that Representative Butler has suggested, and then let me do some negotiations with Ways and Means and with the leadership and see if we can get the money. Because that's a very substantial amount, and the option B, although A is definitely preferable from a policy standpoint, option B costs less. And so that would be my suggestion for how we proceed.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak again to this.
Representative Butler.
I stampede to apologize to beg pardons of my colleagues who did serve with me in the House Committee, Representative Rosenbaum, because this is her bill, and Representative Reed. And Mr. Chair, I think given a little bit of latitude to work with staff, legislative revenue staff, we might be able to take the A option and actually do us a smoother phase-in. Right now it's a kind of a jagged phase-in, 2008, 9, and 10, with one phase-in schedule, and then 2011 and beyond. And while our goal here is not to raise revenue, we might be able to smooth this out a little more so that the amount of net tax expenditure could be less. And we might actually be able to get it out to 2012 as a date of sunset, try to accommodate all of the parties here. I think this is doable.
I
think it's something that we can accomplish. Unfortunately, the number crunching that we're piling on Chris Alamack is pretty daunting. I mean, these are, you've got so many numbers that are moving in so many directions. But I think if we did a separate schedule for each of those years and phase in at a different amount, Mr. Chair, I think that we could get very, very close to the numbers so that it was a net zero game, zero sum, so that we wouldn't be expending $3.3 million, nor $9 nor $13 million. In the process.
Well, that would certainly be my preference if we can figure out how to get there. I mean, this is a wonderful plan. It's a great idea. If one of my tasks that I've been tasked with by leadership and by the co-chairs of Ways and Means is to spend as few dollars as here as we can, so they have the money to spend at universities, community colleges, the schools, the healthcare, public safety, and all those other things.
And Mr. Chair, I might say, and this is, I think I've said it already too many times this session, but the complex work that is done here is only one job deep. This does not take into consideration the net benefits of the expenditure of these resources back into the economy, which help Oregon's the economy. So I think that what this does is, this, while it's not a revenue-raising bill, the closer we can bring it to a net zero game, then what happens is that we are actually pumping money back into the economy. These folks are spending, as our economists will tell us, they're actually expending in excess of 100% of their income. And this helps them make up. When you say, how do they expend more than 100% of their income? This refundability of the credit is part of that excess income that then is available to expend to augment business and to put gas in the car and to get these folks to work and the children to daycare and to take care of their regular daily responsibilities of looking after families and being responsible citizens and raising good families.
Thank you very much. And as you consider a sunset date for this amendment, I think one of the things that I'd be interested in is understanding what information the legislature will have available about the way in which the thing has actually worked at the time they have to consider whether or not to extend the sunset. And so whether that's 11 or 13 or whatever date it is, if we follow the six-year rule, it would be 13. If we shortened it because of some good reason, we'd still want to make certain that there was enough data available for the people in this role then to make a good decision about whether or not to extend it. And that's something I'll leave for the work group and for Chris to figure out when you come to propose it.
I think we could go to the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force and have them help us to get the measurables. And of course, what it is that we're trying to do is we're trying to get off the Oregon Progress Board's list that shows the darn many of Oregonians that are just having trouble getting food to the table on a daily basis.
Well, and of course, it isn't just the Hunger Relief Task Force, but it's also the Department of Revenue and others who actually gather the data, right, so that the committee will have the information it needs at that point to make an appropriate recommendation to the House.
I beg pardon. I thought you were after the performance measures. And
well, that's of interest too, but I'm also interested in the revenue and expense piece. Although I think we don't have performance measures at this point, do we?
We haven't actually outlined any, but of course we didn't get to a mandatory sunset date either. So
yeah. Well, we have only a little bit of time because we need to get this to the Senate if we're going to pass it. Do you think that maybe by the middle of next week you could have an amendment that you think we might be able to work?
Yes, it's been totally on staff. It's very exhaustive work.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's try to do that. Thank you. Now, after all of that, is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2966. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3293. And that's Mary's bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Tell us about House Bill 3293.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3293 removes a sunset date on the property tax exemption for summer homes located on federal land. Actually, it's the land that is exempt, and it's exempt if it's occupied by summer homes that have permits to be there. Under current law, for example, ordinarily when public property is used for private use, the property is taxable. However, under our statutes, the U.S. Forest Service, under our statutes, the land is subject to a forest products or a possessory interest tax, and the homes are taxable, but the land is not. And the sunset date avoids a potential problem in that if the land were taxed, subject to property tax as well as a possessory interest tax, there could be an issue of double taxation. And so the amendment or the bill here is a request to repeal the sunset date so that people don't have to come before the committee periodically to have this date move forward. And there is no revenue impact at the present time because the sunset date is 2012. So for the next two biennium, there wouldn't be an exemption or a revenue impact, but the tax expenditure report does say that for 05-07 there would be there is an impact of about $1.2 million associated with this, and the forest or the permit fees, I believe, to the U.S. Federal Forest Service is about $1.4 million. So it's a sort of a wash right now.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Does the U.S. Forest Service pass any of those fees back to the counties where those...
They do. I think they probably AOC people could probably be more clear on that, but I understand a portion of that is paid to go towards county roads, maybe 25%. I'm not sure about the remainder of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a panel, Christina, Rosemary, and Bob.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and today I'm representing some cabin owner advocates. With me up here is Mr. Bob Irvin, and he is a former executive director of the National Federal Homeowners Association, and I'm looking forward to you directing your questions to him. And to my far right is Mrs. Rosemary Jantz, who has been a volunteer on this issue and has come repeatedly back to this legislature to extend the current sunset since the early 70s. House Bill 3293 proposes to remove the sunset on an existing property tax exemption for both leased and permitted cabins located on federal lands. This exemption applies, as Mary said, to the land under the cabins that's owned by the Forest Service or the BLM. The exemption has been continuously extended through repeated sunsets since it was first adopted in 1975, and therefore no revenue has been collected in 32 years. I know this is somewhat unusual for this committee. Usually you're looking as a policy to add sunsets to exemptions. But the reason we're here as advocates for 3293 is we believe there's an issue of double taxation. And that's because in lieu of paying property taxes on the federally owned land, cabin owners instead pay annual federal permit fees, and those are calculated on 5% of the appraised value of the permitted lots. And 25% of those fees for the federal land use is remitted back to the counties. Attached to my testimony is a spreadsheet that shows the 2002 figures as they relate to the 15 Oregon counties with cabins on federal lands. These permit and lease fees are also annually indexed and typically include substantial increases upon their renewal. And then additionally, on top of the federal permit fees, cabin owners pay annual property taxes to their own counties based on the value of improvements on the federal lot, which include the cabin itself, any other buildings and structures, and improvements such as water or septic systems and electricity. Attached to this testimony is also a representative sample of a property tax statement for a cabin. Oregon cabin owners support the permanent exemption of what would amount to double taxation of properties under federal permits and leases. Various individuals have come to Salem to extend the sunset for the past 30 years, and we believe that House Bill 3293 would permanently extend the exemption, and that might be an appropriate public policy. And with that, I think I'll ask Mr. Irvin and Mrs. Jantz to make some comments.
You first. Thank you. Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, we really appreciate the opportunity to be here to explain what is usually a very different thing for your your committee to look at, and that is getting rid of this sunset. We strongly believe and have since 1975.
For the record, would you state your name,
please? I'm sorry. Thank you. Bob Irvin, E-R-V-I-N.
Thank you. Go ahead.
We firmly believe that this is a case of double taxation, and as a cabin owner in Jefferson County, has been in my family since 1941, we've followed this issue quite closely along those lines. I think for those of you who are not familiar with what we're talking about, cabin in the woods, we are not the Sun Rivers and the Black Buttes and the other prestigious. We are cabins, usually small one- or two-bedroom type places. A limitation here in the state of Oregon is if your cabin burns down and you get permission to rebuild, you can only go to 1,200 square feet. So we have a lot of restrictions, and we've pointed out a couple in the paper that we have sent to you. We also have a situation where, as was pointed out, our fee is based on appraisals of comparable private land. Those appraisals are done every 10 years. The fee for that is the 5% that was mentioned, and then 25% of that does go back to the county in which the cabin is located. This past year, my particular fee for the Forest Service was $1,500. That translates to about $375 that goes back to the county for whatever services that they feel they want to provide. Because of a past appraisal in 2008, that fee will go to at least $3,000, and that will double the amount of money that's going to the cabin, which I have paid, not going to the county, pardon me, for my cabin, which I have paid in my lease fee. So then to have a double taxation situation would be to have an additional property tax levied on that basis. I think that the important thing for you to realize is that these are primarily homes of a second home nature, but also that are not bought with the idea of flipping them or gaining any capital gains from the cabins. They're long, long time held in the families for quite a long period of time. Therefore, we would ask the committee to go along with this and get rid of the sunset provision. Not that we don't like to come before you, but it seems like 30 years of legislative history with the legislators agreeing that this is a double taxation situation would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Chairman Barnhart, thank you for letting us speak on behalf of this issue. 20 years ago...
And you are...
I'm Rosemary Jans.
Thank you.
And our cabin is in the Rogue River National Forest, and it's in Jackson County, and I've been going there, I'm almost embarrassed to tell you how many years, 65-plus years, I would say. So I have a little passion on this issue. And just as an aside, I remember my parents and grandparents paying an annual fee of $5 a year for starters. So I see Representative Butler shaking his head. He must have some perspective there. Well, it's increased, as Mr. Irvin said, it's increased exponentially since then. And some of the things I was thinking that with the amenities that we do not enjoy in this county, even though we pay generously in our permit fees, is if some folks walking along the trail in front of our cabin want to have a picnic on our land, there's nothing we can do about that. It's open. They're not free to come into our cabin, but they are free to sit in the yard there and spread out their blanket and have a picnic. We are not allowed to paint our cabins whatever color we want to. No fences, no grass. We do not, many cabin owners do not enjoy the services of fire protection. If the forest starts to burn, the last thing the rangers are concerned about is our cabin. If the sheriff happens to be driving by, he might help us, but we don't have access to county services in the same way, although we're providing funds through our cabins, our cabin taxes, and also the 25%. Incidentally, it's my understanding that 25% is dedicated to roads and schools, primarily. And... So to avoid some of us having to come back over and over to request this waiver, we would recommend that you consider permanently removing the sunset. Repealing the sunset and just having it not be a consideration. And thank you for your time. I hope I defined our goal here clearly enough.
Thank you very much. Questions for this Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jans, Rosemary, the reason that I got the recognition wasn't that I had one of those $5 leases. It was my recollection that's what gave rise to the possessory interest issue in the first place, was that we felt, I think in local government, state government, there was some feeling that $5 for these cabin sites and the remote areas of Oregon was not indicative of the true market value. If I understand what Mr. Irvin has indicated, that his lot rent is going from 1,500 to 3,000. That's supposed to be 5% of the fair market value. So his lot site has gone from $30,000 in market value. The federal government now values it at $60,000. Mm-hmm. Of course, if it was $5, and we had some of those in Idaho for a long time in Idaho, and finally in Idaho, they did the same thing. They said either the federal government comes in and starts to get those back where they should be, or the counties need to impose a possessory fee on the fact that you've got that right to continue to have those cabins there. So that's what gives rise to my recognition, is that for many years they were valuing those lots at $100 per lot. Now they value them at $30,000 to $60,000, which is probably the fair market value of a lot in the wilderness, something like that.
And am I allowed to respond?
Please do.
The good news is that the federal permit fees are increasing, therefore the 25% that's coming back to the counties for roads and schools is increasing. So that's even though we're not going to, we're trying to avoid the double taxation, the taxation will increase.
And Mr. Chair, I might add that, again, from what Christine McNitt has testified, that what happens is that the fair market value of the site improvements is taxed. And I think that her handout shows that, in fact, the lot improvements goes from $60,000 to $113,000 on the fair market value. Of course, it's still under measures 5 and 50 for increases in fair market value. But that's the reason why this bill was brought forward, was to attempt to address the double taxation issue, particularly where the federal leases are increasing pretty dramatically right now. And that's what gave rise to the large number of concerns of Oregonians that came forward and said, hey, wait a minute, if I'm going to be paying 100% more to the feds for my lease, and you haven't ever collected the possessory interest fee, then why not go ahead and just do away with the sunset and cancel it for good?
Thank you very much. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
And the handout that Representative Butler was just referring to, I had a question actually about what that's. It looks like a property tax statement from Klamath County, but I thought that your testimony was that these properties are exempt from property taxes right now.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, that actually is a property tax statement, and the reason I included it is because it's confusing. Land or cabin owners now pay two taxes. They pay the federal lease fee, and 25% of that goes back to the counties. In addition to that, they also pay property taxes on the improvements. So this is representative of that particular cabin and the improvements on that lot, which may or may not include a septic system, electricity, items like that. So the counties do receive property taxes on the improvements on that federal lot.
And, Mr. Chair, that would not change under this bill. They would still be paying property
That's
taxes
correct.
Every
all,
year on the building, not on the land.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill wouldn't change any current tax structure or revenues, revenue sources to either the federal government or the counties. It would just prevent the need to come back every few years when the possessory interest tax is due to sunset to extend that exemption.
Thank you. I also, just to make certain I understand this, the cabin owner owns the cabin, but has a lease right to the land under the cabin, for which they pay 5% of the value of that lease of that land per year.
Mm-hmm. Of the lot, Mr. Chair, that's correct. And additionally, just another wrinkle that doesn't exactly have to do with this bill, but that lease isn't guaranteed in perpetuity either.
No. So the federal government could at any time say, well, your lease is up, it's time to move on.
Moving out.
Right. So we could find ourselves with a mobile home park bill for forest cabins.
I surely hope not.
Yeah, thank you. I hope not as well. Anyone else? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3293? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3293. We have work sessions that we've carried forward. Senate Bill. Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 653. That's one of yours too, Mary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. They have three of them.
You have three of them, yeah.
Yes. Senate Bill 653 is the one where we had we discussed yesterday. It permits tax exempt entities to claim exemptions for property held under sublease from a taxable owner. The dash two and the four were discussed as two companion amendments that would have to be together, both adopted, both of them.
And we adopted them, yes.
Yes, that's correct. And the dash three was an optional one that would extend that to include exemptions that are held under sublease from exempt entities under any circumstances along the chain, so to speak. I'm not sure that it actually does that. I've had one comment that there might be a glitch in that as well.
Thank you. And we asked yesterday if we could figure out what we wanted to do with the dash threes, and I asked the Oregon Health and Sciences University to clarify that for us. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Behringer with OHSU. We've gone back and taken another look at the dash threes, and our folks are convinced that the dash twos and the dash fours take care of us. That three chain with the private in the middle situation, we don't have it yet, and we don't foresee it in the future. If we do, we can come back and take a look at it at that point in time. There's actually a concern that it may actually, dash threes may do some other things that were unintended, so we are fine right now with adopting the dash twos, the dash fours, taking care of the issue and leaving the threes on the table.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, with the dash two and the dash four amendments having been appended to Senate Bill 653, I move Senate Bill 653 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 653 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I think we have dealt with our questions. Please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes. Aye.
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 Aye. Very good. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 653 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler has volunteered to carry, and so we will do that. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 653. And open a work session on Senate Bill 814. Are we ready on that one?
Which one?
814. 814.
814,
yes,
sir. Are we ready to
work that one today? 814? Yes.
I will defer.
Oh, yes. Okay. It took me a minute to figure out where we were. Now I know where we are. Thank you. I'm sorry. Senator Walker wanted to be notified on the next one. We'll get to that, I hope, soon.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for 814, you have before you two amendments, dash A3 and a dash A4, and they actually pertain to amendments to House Bill 2210, which is a biofuels bill that you heard, or you passed out toward the beginning of the session, actually. And what they are intended to do is address a couple of concerns that have come up after the bill passed out of the House. The dash A3, and both of the issues pertain to the producer credit in House Bill 2210.
Does everyone else have those amendments?
Everybody have the A3 and A4?
I have two.
I have the two. I don't have the three and four.
Well, I just need two. And the A3 and the A4 must deal with corn and then wheat.
That's what I bet he's going to tell us.
Let's see. This sounds like a game of Rook. Corn and wheat, rye, and corner on the market.
All right. Okay. While she's passing them out, why don't you go ahead and explain them to us?
The dash A3 restricts a credit. One of the pieces of the producer credit is a credit for grain crops that's at 90 cents a bushel. And the language of 2210 listed wheat, barley, and triticale, but the language allowed the use of other grains. There were some concerns raised about the use of corn and the effect that it might have on the dairy industry and the cattle industry. So what the dash A3 does on page 2, lines 16 through 18, is restrict any such credit or makes grain corn ineligible for that credit. And that's the sum of the A3.
Okay.
The A4, there was also concern about on the part of wheat exporters, and what the dash A4 does is it restricts the time period for which the credit can be used for wheat. rather than the producer credit in 2210 is applicable for tax years 2007 through 2012. What the Dash A4 does is limit the credit for wheat to tax years 2009 through 2012. It just delays it by 2 years.
Okay, and the deadline, the sunset in House Bill 2210 is January 1, 2013?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that those conform. Who is here who's going to explain why we're doing this? Yes. The Department of... Right. I mean, what, as I understand it, what we're trying to do is make some minor changes in the biofuels situation to conform to some new information that we have. And please, would you let us know what that is?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. That is correct. There were issues that came up both on concern by dairy farmers and about as well as sources of cattle feed and chicken feed, that corn, the incentive, the production, the producer tax credit for corn could give a disproportionate incentive for ethanol production at the expense of these other competing uses for corn. Recently, there was a concern raised not only by wheat exporters, but also by wheat growers, that the there's a similar issue with the incentive for wheat, and the amendments and I think the representatives of all those interests in the room can correct me if I'm wrong, but are supported by them. They take two different approaches. In the case, as Chris mentioned, case of corn and grain corn, that would not be eligible for the tax credit. And we use the word grain corn to distinguish the actual corn grains from corn stalks and corn stover that could be used potentially for cellulosic conversion as that technology improves. Similarly, for the wheat incentive in the Dash 4 amendments, the delay in the incentive is for wheat grain. And again, that approach was the request of the wheat growers. But it doesn't preclude use of other wheat materials, wheat stubble and wheat grass for cellulosic conversion. And these are amendments, as you point out, to House Bill 2210. And as far as I know, there's no objection by anybody who was involved in the provisions of House Bill 2210 to these amendments.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate the Mike's testimony on this matter on behalf of corn. The 90-cent credit on corn, is that per bushel? Or is that per hundredweight bushel?
Mr. Chairman, sir, Butler, give me a moment. I've got to go back and look at the bill language.
Per bushel?
Okay.
And then a follow-up question, if I may.
Yes, please.
What's the effect? What's the effect? It says tax credit is not allowed for grain corn. The tax credit shall be allowed for other corn material. Is that a secondary use of corn, the other corn material?
The corn material, Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler assumes likely for cellulosic conversion.
Oh, insulated should perhaps then?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Other... The essence of these amendments, as I understand it, is that it deals essentially with some of the issues that Representative Butler and others raised at the time we considered House Bill 2210 itself. The whole business of having sufficient grain available for the already existing uses as we move into this era of biofuels. Is that a reasonable way of talking about these amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I think as we've come in with these amendments, they've been narrowly focused as we've learned a little more about the nature of the issues that could be involved.
Yeah, one more question, and I'm going to ask you to speculate just for a moment. Are we likely to see, perhaps not this session, but perhaps later, additional small adjustments to a large bill like the biofuels bill as we experience what happens in the real world as compared to what we thought was going to happen?
Chairman, I think we could. I mean, we're guessing at what the right incentive level is to jumpstart this industry in terms of local growers and lower production without causing disproportionate side effects. And so I think you might. You know, these were the ones that surfaced that people were most concerned about. We haven't had similar testimony or discussions from the other different commodities that are in the bill.
Okay. Everyone's aware, of course, that for this session, at least, we're running out of time.
Yes, so I think, and by the other commodities, the people involved are comfortable with the incentive levels and that it would not cause, at least in the immediate future, significant unintended consequences.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative
Butler. we're in work session.
Please.
And I would like to move the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 814, dated 5-30-07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 814. Discussion? Just another question. You're satisfied that this amendment is drafted correctly to get the object, the result that you want?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I've read it. It looks fine to me, but I leave it to the experts.
I think so. I think everybody involved is fine on this. We think it does what it's intended to do.
All right. Thank you.
And that's how we would interpret it.
Thank you very much. Is there objection to the A3 amendment? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. The A3s are incorporated in the bill.
Representative
Butler.
I move the -A4 amendment be appended to Senate Bill 814. The A4 is dated 5-30-07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the A4 amendment. Discussion? Is there any objection to the A4? Seeing none, the motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 814. As amended today, be moved to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 814 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yeah, Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I recognize that we don't want to give any unfair advantage to any particular grain, but with the price of gasoline, everything that we can do to promote ethanol production would be a good thing.
Thank you. And other comments? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your recalling that I had expressed concern at the time that we did pass the biofuel bill that this should not have an effect on other food source and food chain items for Oregonians. The higher we raise costs for some of these items, then the more likely we are to distort the food costs and increase the food costs. So while we want to get more production of grain crops in Oregon and support the Oasis Project in the process, we really need to make sure that this doesn't increase the food costs for Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I didn't see anything in this bill about Oasis, so that portion of your remarks is out of order, but the rest of it. thank you.
My wife says I've been out of order for years.
For years. I think we probably shouldn't go any further into that. Is there any further discussion of Senate Bill 814? Thank you. Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 The chair votes aye. And with that, with the motion having carried, Senate Bill 814 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass. Unless someone has a burning desire to carry it, I will carry this one. Thank you. Representative Barnhart will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 814. Now, Senator Walker is here, so we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 416. If you'll recall, colleagues from yesterday, was it only yesterday? we were discussing this bill on the dash A9 and A10 amendments. Senator, did you have some other things you wanted to let us know about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, thank you very much. I did a lot of spitting yesterday. I'm done with that. Mr. Chair, in my humble opinion, I think there are two choices on this bill. One is that you pass the bill as we sent it to you from the Senate, and the other would be passing it with the dash A10 amendment. I do not support the A9. I do like my bill the way it came over from the Senate, but I made a commitment in an email to the First Lady when we communicated over the weekend that I would scrap the provision that asked about the five-year, showing 5 years, in the first 5 years, substantial rehabilitation work on the exterior, that we would put that into the task force to discuss how to make the program more accountable. I honor my commitments, and therefore I would be proposing that you pass the Dash 10 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Questions for the senator? Thank you. We very much appreciate your testimony. Let me simply add my sense of this, and if you want to respond, please do. My sense of this bill is that there are a couple of key items in it, the commission being one of them, but the other one being the allowance for local entities to consider the issue of economic distress and the value of property when they consider whether or not to allow property to participate in the special assessment program. And, of course, that is maintained in the bill with the Dash 10 amendments as it exists. And, of course, there's some other changes also that were made. But it seemed to me that was one of the key portions of this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're exactly right. In fact, when I presented this bill to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, all of the members supported that provision. I worked on it pretty extensively trying to find a way to make it work. And the reason they supported it is because I had shared with them two articles, one from Willamette Week dated January 11, 2006, called Home Sweet Home, written by Pulitzer Prize winner Nigel Jaquess. And the Oregonian, Betsy Hammond, wrote an article November 13, 2005, about historic homes enrich the rich. The Oregonian reported that historic tax breaks cost Multnomah County about $6.5 million annually. That's a huge chunk of change. Much of the article was directed at improvements that were done in the Dunthorpe neighborhood, which is a very ritzy neighborhood that I would never be able to afford to live in. And that's no big deal. I can't afford to live there. But what Senator Deckert's point was is people who live in the Dunthorpe neighborhood are most likely going to make sure their home meets the standards of the neighborhood. So, and there were other neighborhoods in the Southwest Hills and elsewhere that were getting these property tax breaks. So we felt that because counties, the citizens of the county and the cities, lose the benefit of these property tax revenues, that they should have something to say about setting parameters about whether the neighborhood is in economic distress and is worthy of getting a tax break at your expense as a member of the community. I love historic preservation. I am so distressed that Eugene got rid of so much of its historic property in urban renewal, and we have very little left. Mr. Chair, you live in Eugene with me. You know that most of it's located in the South Eugene neighborhood around the university area, and we have a couple of historic houses, but everything else was just demolished in the name of urban renewal, and it's sad. I just think architecture is one of the most treasured things, and so the preservation program is important. But it also shouldn't be a giveaway program, and there should be some accountability. So that's what this was all about. That's why, you know, the department, when we were in the work groups, we had like three work groups on this issue on my side of the building. The department had suggested that we look at maybe requesting that you show within the first 5 years substantive rehabilitation work on the exterior of the building, so we at least know you're doing something. But as I said in my communications with the First Lady this weekend, I indicated that I would take that provision out, move it into the task force to have them discuss that issue, and we could bring it back next session, because this program expires in 2010 unless we renew it. It has been a successful program, at least the idea and the concept. I just think that it's gone awry a little bit in requiring accountability, and I'm pretty big on that issue, as I think all of you are.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Butler.
Just one question. Senator, in your work groups, was there any discussion about what happens when these properties are brought back onto the tax rolls with regard to the prior Measure 50 limitations of those properties coming back on at a greater value than what 50 would have allowed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, yes, indeed, there was that conversation. I'm looking through my notes here. That was not a simple statutory fix. I believe it's a constitutional fix, is my recollection, and that's why, because I was willing to, as much as I have strongly disagreed with Mr. Tess on many issues, he did raise that issue in the work group, and I did pursue it, but we found it was going to take a constitutional change, and we were not up for that in this bill.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Walker, is it your understanding that the work group, the task force that comes forward, would be tasked with making some kind of a recommendation, including but not limited to the possibility of an amendment to Measure 50, the recommendations in Measure 50 as you bring these properties back on, that they're brought on at a constitutional value?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, that's exactly what I think this task force would be doing, and that's why in the Dash 10 amendment you'll see that I've added a provision that any other issue concerning the program that the task force determines is necessary or desirable to assist the task force in making the assessment or recommendations required under this subsection. I did not want the task force to be limited to the things that were listed in the bill as it came over to you, because I didn't write that provision of the bill. That came from Ms. McNitt and Mr. Tess and their group. I went along with it, and they wrote that. So when I reviewed the bill this weekend after having conversations with the First Lady by phone and email, I noticed that we would be limited. And some work groups, because I have been on work groups where they have, if it's not spelled out, they will refuse to work on the issue. And so I wanted a catch-all phrase where this work group can do whatever needs to be done. And you're right, Representative Butler, there can be a penalty when you come back off of the Historic Preservation Program with your tax valuation. So I do think if we're interested in making sure this program works, that we should take a look at that issue.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Senator Walker? Thank you. Are we ready on the bill? Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 416, dated May 29th.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves the Dash 10 amendments. A discussion? Is there objection to the Dash 10? Seeing none, the Dash 10 is adopted. Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 416 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves Senate Bill 416 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 416 as amended goes to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And who would like to carry?
I'd be happy to carry it for my old pal.
Representative Rosenbaum will carry. Thank you, Representative. And with that, we are finished with this order of business, and the work session is closed. And I think we've completed our business for today. We did carry over Senate Bill 859, which has been reposted for Monday. And otherwise, we finished our business for today, and we are adjourned.